Preface. This is a book about food and social control. Although this might seem like an unlikely pairing, in truth, the two things go together like peas and carrots, and it's been that way for a very long time. During his famous trip down to the Piraeus, as imagined in Plato's Republic, Socrates and his young companions Glaucon and Adamantus begin to consider how justice first arises in a community. Book 2. After both of the young men have had their chance to speak at some length, Socrates proposes that in order to pursue their inquiry further, they should take the development of a city as a kind of metaphor for the individual's moral development. The three men discuss how, from the start, a division of labour is necessary to supply the community with food, shelter, and clothing, how the functions of each different class of worker are complementary to one another, and how goods will be exchanged through marketplaces where they are bought and sold. Then the conversation turns to the lifestyle of the ordinary people of this imagined community, including the kinds of foods they might eat. Socrates continues, "So let us consider first how our citizens, so equipped, will live. They will produce corn, wine, clothes, and shoes, and will build themselves houses. In summer they will for the most part work unclothed and unshod. In the winter they will be clothed and shod suitably. For food they will prepare wheat meal or barley meal for baking or kneading. They will serve splendid cakes and loaves on rushes or fruit leaves, and will sit down to feast with their children on couches of myrtle and bryony. And they will have wine to drink too, and pray to the gods with garlands on their heads, and enjoy each other's company. And fear of poverty and war will make them keep the numbers of their families within their means." Young Glaucon is quick to object that this is pretty plain fare for a feast, which leads Socrates to concede that the ordinary people would be allowed a few luxuries. These consist of salt, of course, and olive oil and cheese, and different kinds of vegetables to make various country dishes, and we must give them some dessert, figs and peas and beans, and myrtle berries and acorns to roast at the fire as they sip their wine. So they will lead a peaceful and healthy life, and probably die at a ripe old age, bequeathing a similar way of life to their children. But even these luxuries aren't enough for Glaucon. That's just the fodder you would provide if you were founding a community of pigs. The ordinary people must be allowed to recline on couches, eat off tables, and they must have the sort of food we have today, meaning meat and fish as well. Socrates agrees that allowing these things too might actually prove useful to the discussion, but not without introducing an important caveat. Whereas the community that he had been describing was the true one, like a man in health, this new society is one in a fever. This fevered state needs more than mere necessaries and must be enlarged considerably as a result, in occupations, to produce the new goods its people desire, and in territories, to yield more land for pasture and plough as the population increases. And if the neighbouring states are also in a fevered condition, as is likely, then war will follow, since the neighbours will also want to expand beyond their original borders. So now our imagined state requires an army, a new class of guardians. The discussion continues. Interesting, isn't it, that even in the mid-4th century BC, when Plato was writing the Republic, diet was thought to have profound enough effects that a widespread change could turn a once peaceful, harmonious society on its head. Although it's clear that the Republic that is described in the rest of the book is not a strictly vegetarian one, it's equally clear that Plato, or rather, Plato's Socrates, believed the truly ideal community would be one where the workers did not consume meat of any kind. Plato was one of the first social planners. Karl Popper saw him as the father of modern totalitarianism, and today his heirs in organisations like the World Economic Forum have very similar ideas about the necessity of feeding ordinary people the world over a plant-based diet in the name of utopia. This would be something unheralded, a first in human history. They call it the Great Reset, with good reason. While these proposals for a global food transformation are clothed in today's familiar garb of sustainability, equality, health, and well-being, the truth is that the logic is not so far from that underlying the claim Socrates made about the true community. A global, plant-based diet is indeed the right food for a quiescent lower class, and not just because of the physical and mental effects of not eating meat either. This global food transformation will be brought about through a corporate takeover of the entire food supply that will leave the people totally alienated from the production of the food they eat. We will be totally at the mercy of corporations whose only real concern is not our health, nor well-being, nor indeed our rights, nor the proper stewardship of the environment, but their own bottom line, plain and simple. This will be a disaster, and it's only the beginning of the twisted system of control the globalists want to establish. Although this plan is well advanced and has the backing of many of the most powerful individuals and organizations in the world, we still have a chance to stop it. My hope is that this book will not only alert people to the true nature of the problem, but also get them to think about and mobilize effectively against it. Even if you don't agree with all of my ideas, I hope you can agree at least with this one, that we must start to imagine a new way of living, and we must do so fast. Because if we don't, there are others who are more than happy to do so for us instead. And they have a lot to gain at our expense. The whole world, in fact.